Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of the week, both in New Zealand and abroad. And it is now the 25th week of the year, halfway through. As I've mentioned already on the show, the shortest and darkest day down south. Welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Nice to talk to you again.
And I'm going to switch things up a little bit this week. Instead of leaving all the international stuff till the end, we are going to begin with the international news, and I'd like to begin with basically the UK election. I had a little look at our schedule, and we're only going to be talking about it again 2 days before it happens. So this is our last chance to really, I guess, give a rundown of the campaign so far, the first half of it, and then we'll cover the second half of it in 2 weeks. So the big changes, or basically the biggest change, has been that Nigel Farage and Reform have released their manifesto. And they continue to soar in the polls. We had a poll where they were polling equal with the Tories, the UK Conservative Party, both of them at 18% in one poll. And they're averaging about 16 to 17% of the popular vote. So somewhere between a shy third place or second equal. And yet the number of votes that they're, the number of seats that would get them in the House of Commons would be about 7 at the moment because of the first past the post election. So they've got a long way to go if Nigel Farage wants to become the official opposition. And the Tories seem to have kind of dropped the decline in the polls at the moment as well. They seem to have changed their strategy to sort of try and rescue as many of their seats down south as they can. So that's sort of the lie of the land a little bit. And I'll hand it over to you, I think, for your impressions on what you think of the UK election coming up, what you think of the, you know, what's gone on there so far, and what you think should happen in, you know, how our UK listeners should be voting over there.
Well, they should definitely be voting for Reform, I would say.
Well, that was too easy. That was too easy of a question.
Yeah, I was looking at the BBC's poll tracker today, and Reform, if you look at the average of polls, Reform is still polling in third. So roughly, Reform are on an average of around 16%. The Conservative Party on an average of around 21, although that includes a lot of older polls. And so there's a good chance that within a couple of weeks, the average will have caught up, given the sort of trajectory that Reform and the Conservative Party are on. If you look at the direction of travel, Conservatives are going down, Reform's going up. Roughly speaking, things could change, things could be a bit different, but that's roughly it. But you're right, the first past the post system means it's not winning the popular vote that matters, it's winning the individual electoral seats. And that's a much tougher task for the Reform Party because the Conservative candidates are obviously more well-known, it's a more well-established party, a lot of them are incumbents, and so they have name recognition and things like that. And so what Reform is really doing is playing more of a spoiler role, preventing those taking votes away from the Conservative candidates in those electorates, making it much easier for the Labour candidates to win. So they'll get a few candidates in, probably including Nigel Farage, although, I mean, that's still up in the air a little bit, but he's polling ahead in a couple of polls. A lot depends on what sort of tactical voting arrangements people decide to come up with. But chances are Nigel will get in and Clacton. Reform will maybe get a handful of other electorates, but Labour will win big. And then I think that even Nigel and the Reform Party concede that you know, it's going to be a big Labour Party win. And if they're going to get anywhere, it's going to be in future elections. And a lot of that will have to do with the sort of deal they're able to negotiate with the Conservatives. If they are able to negotiate some sort of deal, it's in the Conservatives' interests to be talking to the Reform Party after the election to ensure that Reform don't play a spoiler role like this again. And so in order to get the Labour Party out, assuming they get in at this election, which is very likely, those two parties are going to have to work together and talk together and figure out how they're going to work together to get some sort of general conservative or right-wing victory in future UK elections.
Yes, and a big part of ensuring that there can be some kind of right-wing victory in the future in the UK really does mean that the UK Conservatives need to be destroyed as much as possible. There's an online campaign, the zero seats hashtag, trying to get the Tories down to as close to zero seats as possible. And I believe that's a very good campaign. I mean, they have to be punished for 15 years of betrayal, 15 years of just basically completely destroying the UK. And the argument that they're putting up to say, well, Labour is going to do worse, that's not going to hold up for voters. And it wouldn't hold up for me if I lived over there. It's just been a total and complete betrayal of everything that the voters gave them in the last 15 years.
I don't know if you're a Simpsons fan, but it reminds me of that episode of the aliens, Kodos and Kang, and they each run for president. One is the Republican nominee and one is the Democratic nominee. And they're having a debate and they're talking to the people. And one of them says, well, I don't like either of you. I'm going to vote for a third party. And one of the aliens says, go ahead, throw your vote away. So the moral of the story is you cannot just settle for a system where both parties really terrible. You have to do something different as a circuit breaker so that at least one of those parties changes their policies. And that's really the tactic that's going on here, to try and make the Conservatives change their immigration policy.
Do you believe that there is the opportunity or almost the, yes, the necessity for the United Kingdom to change how it elects the MPs in the House of Commons after this, to switch away from a first-past-the-post model if, say, the second-largest party has very few seats? So that you have I don't believe they've had this situation before where they've had potentially got a party with the second most number of votes that has, say, maybe the fourth or fifth amount of seats in the House of Commons. Like, it seems like that might even be possible. Is that going to force electoral reform in the UK, or you just don't see that happening at all?
I definitely think there will be discussions that will include those sorts of considerations after the election, assuming it turns out the way we're predicting here. Some of those discussions might include changing the electoral system to, you know, like the MMP system we've got in New Zealand, for example, would be a way of solving that. But there are other systems as well. But another part of the conversation might involve a deal that can be done between the Tories and the Reform Party. I don't know exactly how it will turn out, but that's the type of conversations I imagine happening.
Well, yeah, electoral reform would obviously require the Labour Party to implement it. And if the Labour Party has the largest supermajority they've ever had, they'll probably not be super keen on electoral reform. Although you never know if the voters, you know, demand it, well, anything can happen. But yeah, I think something I hadn't really considered very much was that there will have to be some kind of deal in terms of who's standing in which seats moving forward, probably, that comes out, or some kind of merger. I think there are other countries as well where you have two parties that work together and they stand in different parts of the country because they appeal to different types of voters, but they work together well. And you sort of have this in New Zealand. I think the reason why, say, a party like the National Party hasn't split up is because of MMP, whereas I think otherwise you may have run into real problems within the National Party where you'd have, yeah, I guess more kind of urban liberals and rural conservatives who are at odds with each other. And if one of them becomes too powerful in the party, as has basically happened in the UK, then the other voters will completely abandon it because they're not getting any of their policies. They're just able to be completely ignored. Although that can happen in any system. It can absolutely happen in New Zealand system too. And it's, I think, why we do see a little bit of the growth, like after having MMP for many, many years, we've seen the minor parties in New Zealand grow bigger as well. You're seeing the ACT Party grow bigger. You're seeing the Greens grow bigger. And in a large part is that they're permanently pulling more liberal votes away from their respective counterparts. So the Greens are pulling in the more ultra-progressive Labour supporters, and the ACT Party is pulling in more of the ultra-liberal national supporters. And potentially, you'd see a very different configuration in the United Kingdom, but the same principle may end up being in play there.
Yeah, well, MMP was put in place in New Zealand because the National Party often used to win the majority of the electoral seats, but be behind in terms of the party vote. And people thought that was unfair. They wanted a more proportional parliament. And so MMP was a system designed to do that, but also to allow more voices from minor parties to find their way into parliament and to have representation a bit more. And so, I mean, there's definitely problems with MMP, but it has achieved, I think, that goal of making the representation more proportional and reflecting the spread of votes in New Zealand more and allowing some of those other voices to be heard in the parliament.
Another big piece of news this week, international news, in some of the overseas conflicts that we've been tracking has been a report released by the Jerusalem Post saying that the IDF had precise information about Hamas's intentions, but due to prevailing conceptions in the security establishment and possible negligence by officials, the warning signs were not acted on. And so this report states that basically the official plan that Hamas had, and it was the document was detailed end-to-end raid training, and this was distributed in September last year, basically describing in detail all the exercises that Hamas was doing and the kibbutzes they were targeting, and that they were planning to take between 200 and 250 hostages. And in the end, Hamas did take, I believe, 240 hostages, if I remember that correctly. And effectively, all of this was known by Israeli intelligence, and they completely failed to act on any of it.
These are very damaging revelations for the Israeli government. It shows that they were either complacent in terms of their ability to prevent such an attack happening, or they were incompetent in their ability to prevent it. Or perhaps something more sinister shows that they may have allowed the attack to happen. Some people are speculating, to provide a pretext to enable them to carry out their military activities in Gaza. So this is something that some people have speculated about in various places. There has been a goal from some people within the Zionist movement, probably a minority, and even some people in the Israeli government, to try and seize and claim the territory of Gaza and parts of the West Bank, or all of the West Bank, and include it in a greater Israel. And the situation Israel finds itself in now is with it's got deteriorating support from Western countries. It's got deteriorating public relations around the world. And so the strategic calculation, if indeed this is the type of thing that was happening, is that if they're ever going to have a chance to launch military operations to try and take control of those areas, it would probably be better to do it now than to wait while the public support from their allies deteriorates further. And so those are the real options we're left to speculate on. Were they incompetent? Were they complacent? Or were they looking for a pretext to launch the attacks? And all of those options are very bad in terms of the way it makes the Israeli government look to its own people and to everyone else.
Yeah, certainly the domestic situation in Israel is particularly volatile, and there have been, I think I've mentioned in the past, several threats by members of the government to pull out and demanding more action. And you would presume involve some heads rolling at some stage, but so far it doesn't seem like after a few days anyway, the report has been acted on in any serious way. But yeah, there's nothing really to be said beyond the fact that it's quite a damning revelation that the Israeli security services, supposed to be the best in the world, effectively confirmed that they were the best in the world and that they knew exactly what was going on, and that this was simply, you know, not communicated and not planned for whatever the reason was. And presumably this will result in other repercussions down the line, but we just don't know what those are yet.
No. In warfare, when your country's engaged in military operations, there is a sort of rallying round the government type of effect that goes on that may cause the people not to turn on the government. But even with that said, these are very damning revelations, I think.
And now a little bit closer to home, the New Zealand foreign policy has developed a little bit over the last week. We had a visit by the Chinese premier last Friday, and also we've had Luxon overseas for much of this week in Japan, particularly the Air Force plane had some issues getting there. So on the whole, what do you think of Luxon's foreign policy? How's he doing at home here with China, abroad with Japan, and so on, the other plans that he has?
Well, I think in terms of his performance as prime minister, I think he's doing fine. I mean, he was criticized. He sort of put his foot in it a wee bit when he was attempting to criticize the Labour government for putting together like low-powered trade delegations. But in making that criticism, he inadvertently criticized that the caliber of some of the businessmen and other people going on the delegations, that perhaps something he didn't want to do. And so the Labour Party have hit out at him at that, and maybe there's some merit in that criticism. But I think the bigger picture here is the way New Zealand is positioning itself in terms of security alliances to do with the AUKUS and to do with their relationship with China. So New Zealand has been inching closer towards doing a deal with AUKUS, which would be a traditional allies, the US, Australia, and the UK. And it's been considering doing a deal on that front. And the government's been criticized by people like Helen Clark and also Don Brash that doing a deal like that would be moving away from our independent foreign policy. And it would also be jeopardizing the relationship with China, which is our largest trading partner. We send a lot of our exports, and including a lot of our agricultural exports. But nevertheless, I think of these developments. So Luxon gave a speech today. No, it wasn't today.
Maybe a few days ago.
In Japan, where he talked about the relationship between New Zealand and Japan and the closeness of the relationship. The day before that, he talked about sending military vessels and aircraft to Japan to help monitor North Korea's compliance with sanctions that have been put on them to prevent them developing nuclear weapons, nuclear capability. And so I think about all of these developments as New Zealand inching closer to our traditional allies, the US and Australia, and away slightly from our relationship with China. And I think, you know, the Chinese premier visit sort of plays into that narrative a little bit, where there were revelations uncovered there of Chinese interference in New Zealand democracy. So if you remember back a few years now, New Zealand accused China of a cyber hacking arrangement that got into some of our MPs. So Simon O'Connor and Louisa Wall, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this was quite recently though.
And Anne-Marie Brady as well. Mm-hmm. And when the Chinese premier was in New Zealand, there were further revelations of kidnappings by the Chinese government and attempted kidnappings, all part of attempts to interfere in our democratic process. So these sort of revelations and these sort of public revelations and these questionings of the Chinese premier, who's a very high-ranking Chinese official by our reporters, are all kind of can be viewed as sort of signals being sent about unhappiness with the relationship and ways of New Zealand distancing itself from China. And coupled with these other moves, the speech, the conversations with AUKUS, distancing ourselves from China and moving closer to our traditional allies. And I think that's the big picture thing that's going on here.
And to give an update on a issue that we've covered for 3 weeks now, I believe, and it's a story that continues to develop around the census data and the way it was treated at Manurewa Marae, the involvement of John Tamahiri and the Maori Party. A lot of fairly lengthy, probably, investigations are underway. But some interesting analysis was released by Muriel Newman from the New Zealand Centre for Political Research this week, and she's a regular guest on RCR as well. In these numbers, these figures that she's released here, she's specifically mentioned that the census data is basically modified, specifically the ethnicity data is reassessed. That's the time she uses. The ethnicity that you enter in on the census is reassessed. And in that reassessment, they will assign extra ethnicities to people depending on other data that stats collect. If they think you haven't given enough attention to ancestors you might have from other ethnicities, particularly Maori ancestors. And it seems here, I'll just make sure I get the numbers exactly right, the total number that filled in the census saying that they were of Maori descent were 723,000. And then after this reassessment, a further 255,000 Maori were added to the number to give that claim that a million New Zealanders are Maori. But basically a quarter of those didn't identify themselves as such. So we were talking last week about people identifying their ethnicity, but it seems like even if you don't identify your ethnicity, the government will assign you or reassign your ethnicity data. What is your take on this absurd activity by Stats?
It brings the census into disrepute, I think. I mean, I raised concerns about the census on your show 2-3 weeks ago. I thought there were some discrepancies in the numbers, but these revelations are even more damning. So 700,000 people are ticking the box for Maori on the form. And of those 700,000, it's just people identifying. It doesn't necessarily mean they have a whole lot of Maori ancestry. But then Stats New Zealand is going through and adding another 250,000 people who haven't ticked the box based on the use of administrative data. So they must have information in the system that lends them to think they've got Maori ancestor some way back.
Or all of these right-wing extremists who are ticking Maori on the box so they can get faster medical treatment or something, you know, based on all of that being, you know, something that was claimed years ago and people were basically doing it for fun. For all you know, they're taking that people mucking around with their own, you know, ticking boxes for other departments like the health department, and they're just assigning those people on, like, in a serious way.
Yeah, so both ways of getting into the Maori category, very flimsy. For the first way, the box-ticking way, it's just people who identify, right? And you could have a very small amount of Maori blood. Do you need any if you're identifying it? That's debatable. And then the second way is Stats New Zealand are adding extra people in based on any sort of inkling they have of any Maori blood from any of their administrative data. And these people aren't ticking Maori on their ethnicity form themselves. So it throws the Maori category into disrepute. I think there is a political agenda there to try and increase how big the proportion of Maori in New Zealand look for various political reasons. I think there are various people in the government who think it would be a bad look if Maori weren't the second biggest ethnic group in the country. And they are still going to be overtaken very soon anyway. And I think that's
something this was something we brought up previously, basically saying that due to government policy, deliberate government immigration policy and population policy, basically, Maori have been displaced as the largest ethnic minority in New Zealand. And we were saying, well, it was going to happen. But it's clearly already happened. If you look at the data here, they've just fudged the numbers to make it look like it hasn't happened. But in actuality, it has.
You're right. It has happened. And I think the political alliance that's built up has Maori allied largely with factions on the left. And they would be threatened, that alliance would be threatened, if Maori were to come to see the large-scale immigration policies as a threat to their status and their power in New Zealand, in the same way that people like on the right might view large-scale immigration as a threat to their power and status and their identity in New Zealand as well. And so I think they just want to prevent Maori from coming to see that as a threat and perhaps changing their allegiance to some of the people on the right coming to see that they have something in common with those people.
And the other thing that this does is potentially tamper with the electoral seat arrangement. So the number of Maori seats that we have based on the number of people of Maori descent in the population, that is based on the stats data. And this is reassessed every couple of elections. So there seemed to be a very heavy political reason to fudge these numbers, because if they didn't fudge the numbers and the Maori seats decreased by one, for instance, I don't know if that would happen, but that might very well happen or have happened if Stats hadn't fudged the numbers, that would also cause massive political issues, right? The potentially cause civil unrest if it was seen that the government was effectively taking away Maori seats at the next election.
Yep. The way the Maori seats are calculated depends on the Maori share of the population. And if the Maori share of the population reduces, then so does the number of Maori seats. And that wouldn't fit in well with the ideology of many of the people in the public sector who want to increase Maori power and representation in the government.
And I'm just surprised that this hasn't really received much coverage outside of, you know, what Muriel Newman has released and obviously what you've discussed on Twitter and what we're discussing here. The implications of this really don't seem to be picked up in the mainstream at all. Like, there seems to be completely ignoring this angle of the story.
Well, there's two aspects of left-wing policy that are diametrically opposed, and they don't want to reveal that contradiction. On the one hand, they want to position themselves as being on the side of Indigenous rights, and on the other hand, they also want to position themselves as being on the side of large-scale immigration and multiculturalism and everything that goes, and diversity and everything that goes along with that. And if the issue that you and I are discussing here were to become known and discussed in mainstream, it would reveal that those two things are actually in conflict. Another aspect of this story, though, that Muriel raises in her analysis is around the iwi partnership deals that many of our public sector agencies have signed. So they've under the Ardern government, and perhaps before in some cases, many of our ministries and government departments literally signed partnership deals with various iwi. And that creates a real conflict of interest in terms of how they are handling the data, and may have influenced them even, in this case, into making some of these decisions around how they're calculating the Maori proportion of the population. Now, the public service cannot remain neutral and cannot remain in the service of the government of the day if it has these conflicting requirements it's negotiated with various iwi groups. So that's another problem that's going to have to be worked out. And I hope that the review that Prime Minister Luxon has set in motion looks at those type of things.
I did see someone report somewhere, and I'm just going off my memory here, that the person put in charge of this particular review would have considerable conflict of interest as well in kind of whitewashing the outcome of the public sector review. Unfortunately, I can't recall the exact details, but this particular person who's in charge seems to be compromised in a serious way when it comes to these issues, unfortunately.
Is there anyone in the public sector who isn't compromised?
Yeah, maybe that's the problem. And I'm sorry, I don't have the details in front of me and I can't really go and look them up right now. But I guess it may come up again in the future, especially when the reports start to come in from these agencies. Because, of course, someone may have significant conflict of interest and still do a good job. But anyway, so we'll come back to that at a future point if it becomes relevant. Another item that is worth covering is the a discussion that's been brought into New Zealand, and it originated in Australia, and I think there's considered to be bipartisan support in Australia for banning social media registration and usage under the age of 16. So you've got to be 16 years old before you can join social media under proposed Australian legislation. This story was basically brought into New Zealand with both, I believe, the Labour Party and the ACT Party sort of roughly saying that it could be looked into. However, it didn't seem to be a particularly serious proposal in New Zealand. But what's driving this is obviously the fact that they're bringing it up. Why are they trying to ban social media for under 16-year-olds?
Well, I think there are two issues here. There are legitimate issues with social media creating various types of harms, mental harms for young people, particularly young women. And US social scientist Jonathan Haidt has written a book on this, called something like The Anxious Generation. And he's looked at the data and he's seen that as mobile phones, smartphones have become widespread, and as a social media usage has become widespread, there's been an increase in mental health problems among the young people who have been using these devices and these platforms. Increases in depression, increases in suicidal ideation, and it's particularly bad with young women. Young women tend to, they do more of comparing themselves with their peers. And of course, these mobile phones and social media platforms sort of create an online ecosystem where comparing yourself with others is done more frequently and is encouraged. And it creates a sort of a culture where people need that sort of validation of other people liking what they're doing and commenting on it and that sort of thing. And all that can be very unhealthy and create mental problems for young people and especially young women. So there's a legitimate reason. The other reason is that social media is a important vector for distributing right-wing political ideas. So for a long time, conservative ideas, other right-wing political ideas, nationalist political ideas have been shut out from mainstream media And that's starting to change a little bit, I think. But still, it's a very minority view. And the suspicion that many people have is that in the recent EU elections, for example, many of the young people turned to some of the right-wing populist parties. And many believe that one of the main reasons for this was they're going on social media, they're being exposed to these conservative and these right-wing arguments, and it's having an effect on their political beliefs. And of course, the mainstream parties, the left-wing parties, obviously view this change in political views of young people away from them as a bad thing, and perhaps they want to ban it for those reasons. We see a similar thing actually happening in the US, where there's been a move to ban TikTok. Ostensibly, the reason they've wanted to ban TikTok is because they think it's a vector for Chinese influence and Chinese spying and Chinese information gathering and these sorts of things. But the other reason is that the pro-Palestine elements have been very successful in spreading their messages using TikTok. They've sort of outperformed the pro-Israeli messaging on that platform. And so there's been a push from people like the ADL in the US and others to ban TikTok for that reason, because they claim, perhaps unfairly, that it's inculcating anti-Semitic ideas on that platform. So you can see there's, you know, in Europe and the US, various types of social media platforms are being used to successfully get around a mainstream gatekeeping of political ideas. So that's another reason people might be wanting to ban it.
And there was a third potential reason that came to me, and I haven't really seen other people discuss it, but if basically you have to enforce a ban for under 16-year-olds, that would also require ID verification for the use of social media, because that's the only way you could really enforce such a ban, which potentially could also mean the end of anonymity on social media platforms, because people's real identities would have to be attached to their social media accounts. So that's possibly also another angle that's being pushed, especially since anonymous accounts have been very, very successful in spreading certain political messages as well.
Anonymity allows you to get around the problem of personal harm being done to you if you're spreading ideas that certain people don't like. So we see this all the time. People discuss or promote right-wing ideas, they can be cancelled, they can lose their job, they're subjected to claims of racism and white supremacy and homophobia, transphobia, all sorts of things. And it can destroy your reputation and friendships and career. But if you're anonymous, you can get around that problem. And so there's a big incentive there by the gatekeepers, again, to put in some sort of ID system or ban anonymity in some way. So you can see why they'd be interested in that as well.
And yeah, if you really want to think about harm that's being caused to children, there are many other things that you could target or ban first. And especially we've seen this with a lot of the LGBT propaganda, a lot of the trans propaganda, that's incredibly harmful for children. And I was just thinking there's a couple of states in the US where they sort of banned children from like pride parades, or they banned children from drag queen events. And then suddenly they don't want to, they end up canceling the events. Like, oh, there's no children there to groom. We'll cancel the events. It's no longer worth doing. So there's plenty of things that we could be targeting more effectively if we wanted to deal with the issues that are causing harm to children under the age of 16. In the context of social media as well, it can be very, very dangerous for children who are exposed to all kinds of online bullying and harm. And it's just sad to see as well the complete lack of parental supervision and oversight. Like, all of that's been stripped away. And in a large part, that's been stripped away by progressive and liberal ideas as well, saying that parents should be kept out of raising their kids, and that the professionals are going to do it. And that's basically introduced a lot of different predatory elements into the system.
Yeah, and there are always going to be harms the government can't take away, and that parents primarily are going to have to be responsible for managing for their children. And that's not to say that the government should never do anything. I'm not of that view. But primarily, I think it's the role of parents to safeguard their children from harm. And I think that's, you know, when it comes to using the internet, which is the internet is an all pervasive sort of feature of society almost these days. There's really no way of getting around the need for good parenting in terms of how and how much and when and what children use the internet for.
Now, our favorite government department, the Human Rights Commission, has been in the news a few times this week now. One of them is a proposal to, or a desire, I guess, to close now what they're calling ethnic pay gaps. You've heard about the gender pay gap. Well, congratulations. We also have an ethnic pay gap to close. And they've also started detailing massive opposition to government bills now, the latest one being the Fast Track Bill, the Human Rights Commission, claiming that it's going to undermine human rights in some way. I didn't actually read it. It seemed like it would be too boring to read the Human Rights Commission make an argument as to why a infrastructure fast-tracking bill would somehow undermine human rights. But that's, as you can see with all of these issues, completely ideological.
Yeah, the Human Rights Commission really needs to stick to defending legitimate human rights. Otherwise, there's no room for real public policy debates on any of these issues.
Has it ever done its job here in New Zealand, or has it always been controlled by a cabal of its enemies, right? So effectively controlled by people who hate human rights and are just purely advancing the progressive cause?
That's an interesting question, and I couldn't answer it correctly. I'd have to go back and study. It's certainly only become apparent to me in recent years, perhaps under the Ardern government, that it is being used to further left-wing ideology.
Do you believe it that it is like an important government department as well, or is it the kind of a department that should go? Like, is it in an ideal situation, would it be playing a positive role?
Well, I think there is a role for an independent human rights watchdog. Whether it should be associated with the government or not, or some sort of independent entity, is a different question. It's not doing its job. So if a government department like that tasked with defending human rights isn't doing its job, you have to ask whether it should exist. However, I mean, we've got a national government. Paul Goldsmith is the relevant minister here, I believe. I'm not sure why he just doesn't tell them to pull their head into line, why he doesn't get the Human Rights Commissioner into his office and give him a dressing down about why this stuff continues to go on after we have a national government that's been elected in part to sort out silly issues like this.
And on the issue of going back to pay gaps, what's it really complaining about when it comes to, you know, first the gender pay gap and now the ethnic pay gap? Is any of this real? Is it just stirring up trouble, as we've been talking about?
It's stirring up trouble. No matter what kind of groups you divide people up into, they're all going to earn different amounts on average. And none of that means that it's due to discrimination.
Well, if we had a perfect communist society, we could have everyone earn the same amount of money.
And that's really the end goal. They want to equalize things between different groups. And they don't really care whether it's due to discrimination or not. I think some of them actually realize it's not due to discrimination. But if they can tell a bunch of lies about discrimination being the cause of these so-called gaps, then that can, it's been proven very successful in the past to sort of emotionally blackmail people into doing something about closing the gaps. So in a way, it's been an effective political strategy for a long time, this political strategy based on emotional blackmail. So you can see why people continue to do it, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't oppose it and we shouldn't put a stop to it, because, I mean, where does it end? It ends with the destruction of the idea of merit, of the idea of the best person for the job. It ends with the destruction of the idea of a free market system where people are paid according to market rates. We've seen how communism plays out in the real world, and it's not good. It lowers drastically the standards, the living standards, the quality of life of ordinary people. And just trying to sneak communism in through the back door by claiming, you know, that there's pay gaps between every different group you can divide people up into. Now, perhaps you're very clever, but that's not helping society by doing things that way.
And the final item to sort of wrap things up, free speech issue. The real estate agent Janet Dixon is going to court because she's forced to do, well, basically all real estate agents were being forced to do some kind of cultural or Maori sensitivity training course, or I forget the details of it, but perhaps you can fill us in a little bit on what she's hoping to achieve here.
Well, she was told she had to do a some sort of Māori course on Māori culture and tikanga, but she's a real estate agent. And she claimed, well, look, if this was an optional course you had to do, then I would have no objection to it. But they told her it was mandatory, and if she didn't do it, she would lose her her license to be a real estate agent. So she's taken it to court, and she's trying to argue a case that she shouldn't have to lose her license for refusing to do the course. And she's being supported by Hobson's Pledge in that cause. And I think, you know, I think the vast majority of people are behind her. They think that this is a drastic overreach. You should be able to be a real estate agent or any number of other professions without having to do mandatory courses on Māori culture or tikanga or any of this type of stuff.
And it seems to have become increasingly pervasive in all parts of society. I mean, for years or decades even, I know that it's been part of, say, the university system. Just to get a degree in like IT, you had to do a course on the Treaty of Waitangi and tikanga and things like that, you know. So that's been going on for so long, and it's just, I guess, inevitable that they were going to start inserting this into basically every single profession.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of sort of analogies you can draw between this sort of stuff and Maoist type stuff that happened under Mao in China. And it would really be better if this sort of thing didn't happen.
Yeah, and it's like not like any of these things are bad subjects, you know, but the fact that people are basically forced to do them, and there's actually a lot of, I remember, over a decade ago now, there was a lot of opposition to having a compulsory course on the Treaty of Waitangi, basically, and it was boycotted by a lot of students. In terms of class turnout, there were times when there were like three or four students out of a class of 30 who would turn up to their lectures for this. So it was, whether or not opposition to it has grown or shrunk since then, like if people are, because the objection at the time, I remember, was that people are just sick of it. Like, I had to deal with this at high school, I'm just so sick of all of this garbage. And that's not really like the way that you want your country's culture and history treated.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to inculcate a love for a particular culture by forcing it down people's throats in that way. People have to want to buy into it for it to really take hold and have any purchase. So, I mean, in many ways, they're achieving the opposite of what they're setting out to.
And what do you believe the impacts may be in terms of this filtering through into New Zealand's legal system? That seems to be the real objective, I guess, to have tikanga be part of the legal system and to create a very, like, an incredibly subjective standard that would really undermine the rule of law in New Zealand just through the court system.
Well, I think you're right. I think they are. I mean, it is sort of an all-pervasive push to have this thing weaved through all areas of New Zealand life, including ultimately up until the legal system. And it would make it very subjective, wouldn't it? It would give the judges and the other people who were hearing the cases a lot of power to make decisions based on their own values and their own interpretation. It kind of moves us away from a system of the rule of law and towards a system of, you know, the rule of judges and their own subjective interpretations, which is really a backward step.
All right. Well, thank you very much once again for joining me today, William. And it's great to have you on the show for the weekly roundup. And to the listeners, if you've got any particular issues you see during the week you'd like us to cover, please don't hesitate to email them in. Send through your feedback as well, as we did last week. We covered some of the feedback that was relevant directly. So we're always happy to do that. And next week is actually Matariki, public holiday. So your cultural, we've just been speaking about the culture here, that you're being forced to take a day off. That's at least one thing that you won't view negatively, as being forced to take a day off. Definitely something I'm in favor of. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next weekly roundup. So thank you very much again, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Nice to talk to you.
And to the listeners, we will be back right after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.